Good morning and greetings to all. It is certainly a blessing to be back. I see some faces that I don't remember seeing before, so I don't know if some of you have come since we were here the last time. According to my records, I think we were here in 22, maybe. So if you've come here since then, we probably did not meet. We are Don and Marianne Breckbill, and we are privileged to be here today to share with you. We've been married for 44 years. We were married in 1980, and I believe that story that we heard took place in 1981, so that's how long ago that was. Time has a way of slipping by. Well, I've enjoyed your worship so far, and it is a blessing to be here. Intentional marriage. We've been asked to come and share on marriage. I don't know how many of you are married. Some of you are not. You may take notes because you may need them someday, Art. Yes. Well, marriage was God's idea. And what I want to share this morning I'd like to talk about the foundations of marriage or foundational principles for marriage. And this afternoon, then, we want to get into the more practical, everyday relationship things that we face in marriage. So that's sort of how I thought we would address this subject of intentional marriage. You've all heard stories of, and they lived happily ever after. And, we kind of put that belongs to fairy tales and romance novels and things that are mystical or fictional. However, the fact of the matter is that every bride and groom, when they are standing at the marriage altar, they are envisioning a life of happily ever after. They think that's what they're going to experience. That's the intention of every bride and groom. And I have good news for us today, because that can be possible. That can be possible, depending on your definition of happy. That can be possible. The good news about marriage is that God's plan and God's purposes work. God's plan is a good plan for marriage. He did not intend for us to get married and be miserable the rest of our lives. That was not his program. Some people find themselves there, but that is because in some area they are violating or missing or maybe just simply ignorant of what God really intended for marriage. So this morning we want to talk about some foundations for marriage. And so foundational principles for marriage, and see if we can't discover and uncover God's purposes for us in marriage. We have a verse in Psalms chapter 11, verse 3, that says that if the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do? And I guess one of the reasons I want to talk about foundations this morning is that foundations are under attack in our land in ways that I would never have been able to envision 30, 40 years ago. We're seeing things in our society that we could not have imagined possible with all of the gender confusion and all of the breakdown of the biblical and even traditional home structure. And so it's attacking a lot of the foundations of our society, because the family unit is the building block of any society. And when the family unit begins to crumble, what happens? The entire structure begins to crumble. And so foundations are important. And David said, if the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do? And that's a rhetorical question, meaning he did not answer it and maybe did not even intend for it to be answered. And maybe there's not even an answer for it. But let's ponder that a bit. What shall the righteous do when in our society about us, foundational principles are being attacked, and many people are believing the lie, what shall the righteous do? Well, the righteous shall return to the foundations and begin to build upon the foundations. Because the foundations, when that says the foundations be destroyed, that means within a given society. However, the foundations stand solid, stand firm forever. The foundations are going to stand forever. So we don't need to think that there is no hope for us. We can build upon the foundation that cannot be destroyed. That's what the righteous are going to do. And so, you know, we can look about us in society today and we can become overwhelmed with what's taking place. A couple of things I want to say. And, you know, I feel like one of my callings as an old man now is to help the young people to get a grasp on what's happening about us. Because you young people are going to face things that we never face. And we need to understand what is going on. And one of the things that is going on in our society today is the rampant deception. Lies are being spread as though they are truth. And you young people are going to need to learn to discern between truth and lie, between deception and facts. What is factual and what is deception? And one of the things that our society does is that the minority, a minority who want to promote an agenda, present themselves as the majority and as though this is what everybody is doing, this is what everybody is believing, and you're an oddball if you don't believe this, if you don't jump onto our agenda, when the fact of the matter is that it's a lie. The majority are not believing that. And one of the lies that have been propagated is that the majority of marriages end in divorce. Okay? That is a lie that has been propagated. And what does that do to young people who are considering marriage if they look at the statistics or listen to the lies that are being propagated and they say, well, if the majority of marriages end in divorce, what hope is there for marriage? Why should I bother getting married? Well, the fact of the matter is that's a lie. I read a book here recently, and this was written by a lady who was a statistics analyst, and she looked at the statistics, and divorce statistics are really hard to analyze because there are so many anomalies in the statistics that it's hard to say what is the divorce statistics. But her analysis was that in the U.S. population in general, if you take the population in general, 67% of first-time marriages last a lifetime. Now, that's quite different from what we often hear, that over half the marriages end in divorce. And that may be true, that statement may be true if you take into account second, third marriages and multiple marriages. That statement may end up being true. However, the fact of the matter is, the good news is, 67% of marriages in the United States last a lifetime, and that not even taking into account whether or not they're Christian or church-going people. And what that tells me is this, that God has built into marriage some enduring qualities. It's the kind of a relationship that you don't just walk away from. There are enduring qualities built into marriage, even outside of a relationship with Jesus Christ and association with the church. Even in society in general, there are enduring qualities that are built into marriage. Marriage continues to be, heterosexual marriage, I'm saying, continues to be the mainstay of society at large. And I think that is probably true of any nation, that marriage continues to be a solid relationship, a solid entity with which societies are built. And that's because of how God's design in building marriages. He built into it that it is a solid, enduring relationship. So that's good news. And that's good news for young people that are considering marriage. There are a lot of happy marriages, and yours can be a happy marriage. And if we follow God's ways, God's principles, we can have a happy marriage. I have done a lot of teaching on marriage, and yet I still come to this subject with a certain amount of trepidation. And that is because that we talked about society in general, even within our Anabaptist circles, there is a lot of misconceptions and a lot of, I would say, unbiblical counsel given. And it is undermining and destroying a lot of marriages. And so some of the principles that we're going to be talking about this morning may be averse to what you might read if you pick up a lot of marriage manuals, and what you might counsel that you might receive even in an Anabaptist counseling center, because that's just the nature of the principles of the kingdom of heaven. They are averse to our carnal nature. They are averse to human reasoning. They are averse, that means different than, opposite than our carnal way of thinking. And so in order to understand God's ways, Paul said at one place, the carnal mind does not understand the things of the Spirit because they are spiritually discerned. So this morning, to understand these principles, we need to, there's some basic things that we need to understand. One is, we believe that the Word of God is true and that it is the final authority for our lives. And we believe that as we apply those principles to our lives, that God's ways work. So that's the premise with which we approach this subject. The kingdom of heaven, the principles of the kingdom of heaven are averse to the ways of the world. And the principles of marriage today are kingdom principles as taught by Jesus. And they will not be palatable to the carnal mind. So we need to understand that. I thought about calling this first message the Genesis of Marriage, because we're going to go back to the book of Genesis and begin at the beginning. Marriage was God's idea. He performed the first wedding ceremony in the Garden of Eden at the time of creation. So it was God's idea. So we need to understand what God had in mind, and we need to go back and see what God had to say about marriage. In Genesis chapter 1, I'd like to read 3 verses. And God said, "Let us make man after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, "Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And that makes us very, very different from the animals. God created the animals previously. But when God created man, he said, "We're going to create man in our image and after our likeness." And that means a lot of things that we could spend a lot of time talking about. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? To make a long story short, it means that we have the ability to reason. We have the ability to choose. We have the ability to, we have the propensity or the desire to worship. But above and beyond that, we have the ability to have a relationship with our Creator in a way that the animals do not have. But as we look at that verse, "Let us make man in on our image," I believe that God created, that men were created in the image of God, and I believe that women were created in the image of God. When he said, "Let us make man in our own image," he was talking about mankind. And the interesting thing, one interesting thing about this is that as a man, becomes more godly, he becomes more masculine. His masculine traits that God created him with become more pronounced. He becomes more like God intended men to be. But the interesting thing is that as a woman becomes more godly, her feminine traits become more pronounced. She becomes all that God created her as a woman to be. So this is something that only God could do, create male and female, two very different beings in his image and in his likeness, and yet both of them, as they move toward godliness, become more feminine, masculine. We become more of that which God created us to be. And only God could do that. Marriage now is the bringing together of these two very different beings, a male and a female, a man and a woman, coming together in marriage. And there's something about marriage that as you have a godly man and a godly woman coming together in marriage, that union represents the image of God in a much more complete and whole way than either could individually. So marriage also reflects the image of God. And we could go back, I don't know, is there a clock in this place? I don't know how much time we have or how much time we want to spend on this, but we could go back and look at even, well, I think we're going to come to that later on, so why don't we just keep moving forward. Marriage was designed to reflect the divine image, together husband and wife, more fully complete the image or likeness of God. The husband brings into the marriage logic, initiative, creativity. The wife brings into the marriage intuitiveness, tenderness, nurturing, and together they have the ability to create new life and to nurture another generation. So this was God's plan. And we're going to be talking more about that plan. Marriage was God's idea. He looked at it. He said it is good. As a matter of fact, he said it is very good. Moving into Genesis chapter 2. Thank you, Arthur. God bless you. Yeah, I did. I discovered that one. Now I discovered that one. Okay, we have plenty of clocks in this place. Thank you. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, and the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make an helper suitable for him. I know the King James says help meet for him. And I kind of, people talk to about their wife. This is my help meet. And I guess it's okay to say that. But what that means is this is my helper who was created uniquely for me and suitable for me to complement me. That's what that means. But we say, well, this is my helpmeet. Some people refer to their wife as their helpmeet, and that's okay. It means a helper suitable for. But what we want to look at is that God said, okay, God created the animals. He created all of creation. He said it is very good. He created man and put him in the garden. And here, God looking at man alone in the garden, he says, it is not good that this man should be alone. What did God mean by that, and why did he say that? He said, I will make him a helper that is suitable for him, not inferior to him, not superior to him, but rather a complementary image of himself, one that complements him in every way. So where he was weak, there she will be strong. Where he is strong, there she will be weak. They will be made to complement each other so that as when they come together into marriage, they make a complete whole union. A mutual compatibility, a healthy codependency is what God meant when he said, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper that is suitable for him. Now, it's interesting to note that the woman was made of that which was taken out of the man. So he no longer has that part. And that's the way it is in marriage. There's something about when we get married, we get our rib back and we're able to feel whole again. we are now complete. As a matter of fact, I've said it this way already. When a guy takes a girl out on a date, and she gets into the vehicle with him, and they're driving down the road, just that setting, just a man, a guy having a girl in the vehicle with him going out on a date, just that experience meets a very fundamental need in a man's life. We're not talking about sexual fulfillment. We're not talking about marriage. We're not even talking about commitment at this point. We're just talking about having my rib back in place and feeling whole again. I don't know that you girls understand that fully. You probably won't understand that fully, but every man needs a wife. I won't mention any names. Well, actually, since we're talking to Arthur, the Jews in their day said this. I don't know if they still say it today or not. Any man over 21 that's not married is a menace to society. That was their philosophy. Take it or leave it. So when God said it is not good for man to be alone, what did he mean by that? What did he mean by that? What was God seeing in Adam when he said, it is not good for man to be alone? What I'm going to share next, this was not original with me, but this was so... This was so insightful, and actually, I think changed my perspective on marriage, because I was a very selfish person when I got married. Yeah, I loved my bride and wanted her happiness, but I was also concerned about my happiness. And looking back, I realized I was probably more concerned about my happiness than I was about her happiness, and that kind of revealed itself as life unfolded. However, what God's intention for marriage is that there be mutual happiness. Where was I going with that thought? What was God thinking when he said, it's not good for man to be alone? Oh, I was talking about this book that I read by Gary Thomas by the name of Sacred Marriage. If you haven't read it, I would encourage you to get it and read it, because he gives a very different perspective on marriage. And this is what he said. What if God designed marriage to make us holy rather than to make us happy? Oh, maybe it's more about becoming holy, marriage as a means to holiness, as opposed to marriage as a means to happiness. Because God is much more concerned about our holiness than he is our happiness. He's more concerned about our sanctification than he is our comfort. And so when God said it's not good for man to be alone, perhaps he was thinking about more than he doesn't have a cook, he doesn't have someone to care for him. Maybe he was thinking about the fact that man living alone is going to have this propensity to become extremely selfish. Marriage forces us to confront our selfishness. And any situation that calls us to confront our selfishness has enormous spiritual value. So get married, and it will expose your selfishness. And you will be forced to deal with it. You will have to deal with it, because you can't remain selfish and live happily ever after. Those two are not mutually compatible. Suppose that God designed marriage to teach us how to love. See Adam in the Garden of Eden, surrounded with all of the fruits of the earth and everything that he needed for life and sustenance. How could Adam possibly learn how to love? How could he learn how to love if there's no one there for him to love? So God created marriage, designed marriage to help us to learn the depths and the riches of a loving relationship. That's part of what God has built into marriage. Supposing that God designed marriage to expose our sin, ouch. Supposing God designed this intimate relationship where there's no place to hide, where everything that we are is laid out in the open for our wife, our husband to see. They see us as we truly are, and we can't hide. This relationship is so intimate that there is no place to hide. Supposing God had that in mind, marriage forces us to honestly face our pride and our selfishness and our lust and our ungodly attitudes. Our marriage partner becomes like a mirror to us. You know, we go to the mirror to groom, but you know, when we crawl out of bed, right? First thing you don't want to do is look in the mirror, because what you see is not good. Well, our marriage partner becomes like a mirror, and our real self is exposed with all of its deformities and all of its shortcomings. So marriage does that to us. Do not give in to the temptation of resenting your partner for revealing your weaknesses. And this is what often happens in marriage. And when couples come for marriage counseling, it's because she is aware of his failures, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with that. And so don't resent the fact that your partner exposes your weaknesses. Rather, use that as a means of growth, of personal growth. God designed marriage to teach us how to pray. Peter said, giving honor unto the wife as the weaker vessel, that your prayers be not hindered. If a man has not learned how to serve his wife, to respect her, to be considerate of her, his spirituality is still infantile. Marriage forces us into the intense act of reconciliation. So marriage, probably all of the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount were given opportunity to experience those in marriage. As a matter of fact, a big difference, well, let me just reword it. One of the things that we often run into in marriage is, let me try again. If you take the principles of the Sermon on the Mount, the principles that Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount, he said we're supposed to love our enemies, we're supposed to bless those that curse us, we're supposed to do good to those that hate us, we're supposed to forgive those that trespass against us, we're supposed to go the second mile. Okay, these are kingdom principles that we talk about, and we say, we Anabaptist people believe in the principles of the Sermon on the Mount. That's the way Christians are supposed to live. Okay, take those principles and apply them in your marriage. And what does that do to your marriage? All of a sudden, you have a new covenant marriage. And I want to assure you that is actually the resolution to a lot of marriage problems. But the fact of the matter is that what we find in our, even in our Anabaptist circles, when you talk to people about doing that, applying those principles to their marriage, sometimes you get resistance. But you don't know how he has hurt me. But I'm supposed to forgive that, and that's it, and that's over? Are we kingdom Christians, or are we not? And sometimes it's really the only way forward is to apply those principles to our marriage. So marriage, God designed marriage to give us opportunity to learn forgiveness and to learn reconciliation. Forgiveness is not running from conflict. Forgiveness is moving towards each other. Forgiveness is releasing your partner of your legal rights. Forgiveness is never fair. Forgiveness is never easy, because it costs us. It means that we pay the price for somebody else's sin. Forgiveness is never fair. Forgiveness does not guarantee reconciliation, but forgiveness does open the door for reconciliation to happen. It takes two to reconcile. One can forgive, but it takes two to reconcile. At least that's how I understand it. And we already heard a little bit about bitterness, and this quote came from, I'm not going to be able to think of her name. Bitterness is an acid. It destroys the vessel that contains it. It does more harm to the one who contains it than it does to anyone else. God designed marriage as a platform for service. Before you share your faith with others, you need to demonstrate that your faith makes a difference in your own home. And a spiritually alive marriage will remain a marriage of two individuals in pursuit of a common vision outside of themselves. And this is the crowning fruit of spiritual intimacy. And talking about living happily ever after. I don't think we read anywhere that is a promise that, you know, if you're married, you're going to live happily ever after. Yes, happily married, but that doesn't mean that we just enjoy a lifetime of pleasure. Marriage needs to have a goal beyond just the marriage. And of course, one of those is raising a generation of godly sons and daughters. That should be a goal of every marriage, to raise up a generation of godly sons and daughters. But above and beyond that, serving the Lord in whatever capacity the Lord calls you to. If that means going to Guatemala as a missionary and experiencing what John Troyer experienced, that was not easy. I'm sure there was a lot of difficulty involved in that. As a matter of fact, I think sometimes, probably all of you have read Laura Ingalls' stories about pioneer life, and you think about these pioneer wives who, their husband gets his harebrained idea of going west, and they pull everything out of their comfortable houses back east here, pack it in a Conestoga wagon with a couple of oxen or horses pulling it, and say goodbye, Mom, goodbye. No cell phones, no GPS, nothing, no contact with what they're leaving behind, but they're following their husband because this is his vision, and they're supporting his vision, and they dedicated their life to making it happen. How about in our day? If your husband is called to some area of service, or maybe called to the mission field, or called to some sort of lifestyle that calls for sacrifice on your part, are you willing to get behind him and support him and be that kind of... So God designed marriage as a platform for service. It's not just about us. It's not just about our happiness. It's about serving God together in whatever capacity he calls us to. God designed marriage to teach us to suffer. And this is a hard subject to talk about because I don't like to suffer any more than anyone else here. But God designed marriage to teach us to suffer. There are certain sorrows that are unique to the married state. Paul talked about some of them. He said, such shall have trouble in the flesh. So it's just simply childbearing is one form of suffering. But then to care deeply and to love deeply is to make yourself vulnerable to suffering. If you're going to care deeply and love deeply, you're setting yourself up for suffering. Let me share this story from when I was a child. I don't know how old I was, probably 6 or 7 years old, something like that. Anyway, lived on a dairy farm, and we had lots of cats. Cats everywhere. I mean, when the vacuum pump stopped, cats descended on the milk dish from all points of the farm, and it was not uncommon to have 20, 25 cats scrambling, all trying to drink from the milk dish at one time. It was a mass of cats. And then the spring of the year, you have litters of cats all over the place. And there was cats for everyone. If you wanted to claim a cat for yourself, no competition. You could claim any cat that you want. Well, one spring, there was this little kitten born on our farm, a little calico kitten, cute little calico kitten. And of all the cats on our farm, I decided, this is going to be my kitten. I'm going to claim this one for myself. Nobody cared. There's plenty of cats for everybody. You can claim any kitten you want. But claiming a kitten means that, I mean, most of the cats were wild. They would hiss at you, scratch. But if you get them when they're young enough, you can tame them and make them into pets. And so I claimed this one as a little kitten, and this was my pet kitten. And one day I was walking up around behind a barn, and I saw my pet kitten on the neighbor's there was a house behind the barn, and the pet kitten was back there on the neighbor's grass, and the neighbor's dog was coming after it. And I saw the dog pick up my kitten, shake it fiercely, and toss it into a heap. That was the end of my kitten. I went over and gathered up my little kitten. It was dead. nothing I could do for it, but bury it. So that's what I did. I got a shovel, and I went out behind the barn, and I dug a hole, and with tears running down my face, I buried my kitten in the dirt and covered it up. And as I was carrying that shovel back to the shop, I said to myself, I am never going to love another kitten. It hurts too much. And I can't really say that I ever gave my heart to a kitten again. But I met Marianne, and I decided I'm going to risk it. I haven't been sorry. But if you're going to love, the more deeply you love, the more deeply you set yourself up to suffer and to hurt. Just disappointments. And then eventually there will come a parting for every marriage. There will come a parting for every marriage. So God designed marriage to teach us to suffer. In our Western world, suffering is a bad word. We view that as something you avoid at all costs. And we have all kinds of medications and all kinds of ways to eliminate and alleviate suffering. However, in many parts of the world, suffering is a way of life. And I think we have become soft in our desperate desire to avoid suffering at all costs. We have become soft. And even within marriage, when marriage comes to the place where I have to suffer because of this marriage, many times we look for a way out and for some way to avoid suffering. Peter wrote, these are the words of the Apostle Peter, but the God of all grace, after that you have suffered a while, make you perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. And I want to tell you that there are some characteristics, godly characteristics, that there's only one way to learn them, and that is through the valley of suffering. Suffering is not a bad word. Suffering can develop within us graces that cannot be developed in any other way. I have had a bout with cancer here a couple years ago, and in that whole process, I had the privilege of interacting with a lot of other people who had cancer. And I realized that there was some quality about them that I really came to admire. Something about having reckoned with your mortality, realized that something is growing within you that you can't do anything about, that you cast yourself on the Lord's mercy. And there was a quality that was developed in those people that could not be developed in any other way. I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but I'm simply saying suffering is not all bad. It can have a wonderful effect on us if we allow it to. So God said it's not good for man to be alone. The other thing that I want us to notice is that what I want to talk about next is that marriage is a covenant relationship. It is a covenant relationship. And in our day, you know, we talk about that, but in our day, we don't have a lot of things that we can connect to that we understand the nature of covenant because in our day we have a lot of contracts, but other than we view the baptismal vows as a covenant between us and God, but apart from that and marriage are really the only kinds of covenant that we really are able to relate to. Whereas back in the Bible times, it would have been other kinds of covenants, you have Bedouin tribes, and they would make a covenant with one another, and they had different ways of doing that, but they would make a covenant with one another, and that was considered to be binding above and beyond just a verbal agreement. That was like, you know, that was like a blood covenant. That was like breaking this is like results in death. I mean, it was a binding relationship. I don't know how they did it. Sometimes I read somewhere that sometimes they would have like a salt covenant. They would come together. He would bring his salt. Both tribes, leaders of both tribes, would bring their salt, and they would pour it together into a common bowl. And it was like, if you can separate this salt out, then this covenant can be broken. Impossible to do. No one could ever do that. And so they understood the nature of covenant. In Genesis, where God made a covenant with Abraham, that mysterious chapter where God told Abraham to take these animals and cut them in half, divide them in half, and a horror of great darkness came down upon him, and this light passed, this smoking furnace passed between the pieces of the sacrifice, and we're like, ooh, what was that about? Well, that was God's way of making a covenant with Abraham. And in Hebrews, it talks about two immutable things, God's word and God's covenant. And that those things, they are immutable. That means they cannot be broken. And that is the nature of a marriage covenant. In Malachi, we have this verse that says, "And wherefore, and yet you say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and the wife of thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant." Notice there was treachery here, but the treachery did not disannul the covenant. "Yet is she thy companion and the wife of thy covenant." And I point out that verse because that's really the only verse in the Bible that directly refers to marriage as a covenant. Nevertheless, we believe that marriage is a covenant relationship. God chose to relate in covenant. That was his way of relating to us, his people. Creation was a covenant work. And it's not so evident, but if you study Genesis 1:1, where it says, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth," the word for God there is Elohim. And Elohim is a plural word. It's our first indication of the Trinity. In other words, there's more than one behind this. This was, creation was a work of the Godhead. It was a covenant work of the Godhead. They agreed together to create the world, and in the New Testament we read that Jesus is referred to as the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So all of this was in the mind of God at the creation of the world. But covenant was God's way of relating. He made a covenant with Adam and Eve. He said, "I will put enmity between thee and the woman, thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." God made a covenant with Noah. He put the bow in the sky. He said, "I do set my bow in the cloud. It shall be for a token of the covenant between me and the earth, that I will never again destroy the world with a flood." God made a covenant with Abraham, where he talked about that, said to Abraham, "Look at the sky. Look at the stars. Count them if you can. Your seed is going to be like the stars of heaven for multitude." So God, again and again, chose to relate in covenant. And then God made a covenant with you and I. And that covenant was ratified at Mount Calvary when Jesus shed his blood. Hebrew says, "For this is a covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts. I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more." So we call it the new covenant. And we do not worry that God is going to renege on his covenant that he made with us. We call it assurance of salvation. It is based upon the fact that God made a covenant and verified that covenant at Calvary. And today we build our lives, we place our faith in what Jesus did for us at Mount Calvary. And we don't live in constant fear that God's going to change his mind. That's the nature of covenant. How does a covenant differ from a contract? A covenant is based upon trust between two parties. A contract is based on distrust. The reason we do a contract is because if I'm going to build this building for this guy and he's only going to put half the money down, I want a contract. I want some sort of a written agreement that he's going to pay the balance after the building's done. So we write a contract. It's based on distrust. A covenant is based on trust. A covenant is based on unlimited responsibility. A contract is based on limited liability. And that's why we have LLCs, limited liability. If someone wants to sue me and I have an LLC, they can only take what is listed under the LLC. They cannot take my personal house or my personal goods. A covenant is based on unlimited responsibility. I'm going into this marriage. I don't know what it's going to bring. I don't know what we're going to face, but I am making this commitment to be faithful, to love my wife till death do us part, regardless of what that costs me. A covenant cannot be annulled under any circumstances. A contract can be voided by mutual consent. Just simply two people deciding they don't want to be married anymore does not disannul a covenant. You can't just walk away from a marriage. You can't just walk away from a covenant relationship. A marriage covenant is of divine origin. A contract is of human origin. This is something that God recognizes and God blesses and that God holds us to. So a marriage covenant is not only binding on the human level, it's also binding on the divine level. God demonstrated his faithfulness in keeping covenant with unfaithful Israel. And I'm not going to take time to do a lot of on this, but God made a covenant with Israel. She was unfaithful to him. She broke covenant. He called her adulterer for bowing to pagan idols. And yet, the prophets, as you read through the prophets, basically what is happening there is God is, through the prophets, he is calling Israel back to her covenant. He is calling her to repent, to turn, to call back, to come back. That is basically the message of the prophets, was to call his wayward wife, Israel, back to himself. God wasn't going to renege on his covenant. He was keeping his part, but he was calling his wayward wife back unto himself. For the mountains shall depart, the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord, that hath mercy on thee. Incline your ear and come unto me, hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. So marriage is a covenant relationship. On our wedding day, we so sweetly said, I promise to love you and to cherish you, to provide and care for you in sickness, in health and sickness, in prosperity and adversity. I promise to exercise patience, kindness, forbearance toward you, and to live with you in peace as becomes a faithful Christian husband, and forsaking all others, to keep myself only to you as long as we both shall live. When I'm at a wedding and I hear that bride and groom make those promises, sometimes I feel the hair standing up on my neck because I realize that this young couple has no idea what they are promising. When I was standing there, I had no idea what I was promising. I promised to love you till death do us part. On our wedding day, we can have no idea what that is going to cost in the course of a lifetime or what that is going to mean in the course of a lifetime. And yet we rush to the marriage altar and we make those promises, and it's because we love one another, and we are willing to pay the price, whatever it is, to be able to spend our lives together with one another. Words sweetly spoken that cannot be broken, each for the other and both for the Lord. I believe that there are three basic components that make up a covenant. And if you do a study of covenants, you'll find these three basic components present nearly every time that there is a covenant established. One is words. There is the terms of the covenant are clearly defined. When God made covenant with Israel, we have Exodus, Leviticus, all of the terms of the covenant that God made with Israel. There are witnesses. And that's why at our weddings we have witnesses. All of the guests are at a wedding are witnesses. You're called, invited to the wedding to be a witness to the wedding. And then there is that which seals or ratifies the covenant, which makes it binding. And in marriage, that is the one flesh union that seals or ratifies or makes this marriage officially binding, complete, whole. This marriage is now complete and this marriage is now fixed. We have the blood of Jesus that ratifies or that makes the new covenant whole and binding. And you know, at communion time, when we take the bread and the cup, and Jesus said, except you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. That's a way that we commemorate and we remember this blessed wholeness, this blessed oneness that we have with Jesus. We remember the covenant relationship that we have entered into with Jesus. So, marriage is a covenant. It is a durable relationship. It is one that, and that's one of the things that makes marriage such a blessing, is that we can relate to one another. This isn't a master-slave relationship. This is not an employer-employee relationship that could be terminated or changed at will. This is a covenant relationship that is established for life. Therefore, we can enjoy this relationship. We can relax. We don't need to worry that he or she is going to renege on the relationship. I'm talking about if this is a godly marriage. Yes, there are plenty of people who do worry about that. As a matter of fact, in the world, getting married outside of Christ has got to be one of the scariest, most risky things that you could do, because there's no guarantee if this is not a godly marriage. And that's why Paul said only in the Lord, because this is to be a relationship that is built upon the principles of God's word. So we want to leave, I want to encourage us to a legacy of faithfulness. One of the things that grieves us is, and this is creeping into our Anabaptist circles, how quickly and how easily some people walk away from their marriage. Just yesterday, we heard of another marriage that was just broken up. She went to a marriage counselor, and he said the best thing you could do is leave your husband. And I don't know what the details were. I really don't know. But we feel, Marianne and I are alarmed at the amount of marriages in Anabaptist circles that are being broken up. And it's like, do we believe these principles or not? Are we willing to suffer for a marriage? Are we willing to expend ourselves for the marriage, or are we not? I'm not saying that there's never a time for that, but there is far too many marriages being broken up in our Anabaptist circles just over, well, maybe not trivial things, but things that could be resolved if we were to take the principles of the Word of God and apply them to our marriage. So what we want is to leave to our children and grandchildren a legacy of faithfulness. How do you want your children and grandchildren to talk about your marriage after you're gone? Do they want you to say, Grandma and Grandpa never seemed to be able to get along. They couldn't get their act together. They just lived in constant bickering. Their home was always filled with tension. Is that the kind of legacy that you want to leave? And when we talk about a legacy, it's not just a memory. This is about how we relate affects our children and our grandchildren and their marriages and how they will relate. It's amazing how quickly it is passed down. I'm thinking of a marriage that ended in divorce. And these people both grew up in an Anabaptist church, and it ended in divorce. And they had all kinds of justifications for this divorce. They thought it was justifiable, the right thing to do. And she married a pastor and raised a family and thought that this was justifiable. Well, the problem is the next generation, every one of their marriages ended in divorce. It's like, so what was gained by that? Was it really as justifiable as she thought it was? If you want to create a lasting legacy, one that will be a blessing to future generations, then develop the covenant-keeping heart of God. This is not only for the purpose of creating a lasting legacy, but also for the purpose of, it is amazing how you view marriage impacts how you resolve problems along the way. If you view marriage as something that is transient, disposable, then that's going to factor into how you deal with problems. I don't need to deal with this. I can walk away. And maybe you don't leave your wife or your husband for a long period of time. Maybe you just simply build a wall that you refuse to cross. I don't want to talk about it. You know, I'm closing that part of my heart to you. I don't want to go there. Just stay out of that area of my life. And you might continue to live together as husband and wife and smile on Sunday morning and appear to be happy, but you've lost intimacy. You've lost the oneness that God intended for you to have. And it's going to show in the lives of your children and grandchildren. So I want to encourage you to a legacy of faithfulness. Keeping covenant is more than just staying together. It means that I'm going to love my spouse even though I get no love in return. Ooh, that is hard. And I'm not telling you that would be easy. That would be hard. But that is the nature of covenant. That is what God did with Israel. Continued loving them, continued giving, continued investing in them, even though they were not returning his love. It means that I'm going to sacrifice for this relationship, even though it seems like it's a waste of time and energy. I'm going to continue to pour myself into this relationship. It means that I'm going to do it as unto the Lord, seeking no rewards from others. It means that even though my spouse may totally abandon me, I am committed to the promises that I made on our wedding day. I don't know if I should tell you this story or not. I only ever told it once, and that was at a marriage seminar. And the reason I've been reluctant to say it is that it blows your mind so bad that I worry about what kind of I worry that you reject my whole message because it ended with this story, okay? So don't do that. Don't do that. I'll tell you that up front. Don't do that. If you don't agree with what this wife did, then just lay it aside. Don't judge my whole sermon by what I tell you. And another reason I didn't share this is because this story does blow your mind. Anyways, this story was told me by John D. Martin. You got the purple hymnal. It's the man who compiled that book. He's the one who told me that story. If you want to verify it, go talk to him. He said that they had neighbors who lived across the road from them. And they were Mennonites, or she was a Mennonite. No, wait a minute. I don't know that they were Mennonite. I don't know that they were Mennonite. Don't let me backtrack on that. But they lived across the road from John D. At some point. And he was an ungodly man. And he actually would bring his girlfriend home and spend the night with his girlfriend in their house. And this wife would get up the next morning and would make breakfast for them. Whew. See why I say this blows you away? But, and I'm not saying, I don't know what she would do in a situation like that, but that's what she did. And the last chapter is that when this man was on his deathbed, she was able to lead him to the Lord. And I don't think that would have happened if she would have done what many wives would do in a situation like that. If she would have ran, that would have taken the grace of God, and only by the grace of God could someone do that. But this is the level of commitment that used to be in marriage. And it seems that today, many people do not have anywhere near that level of commitment. If I'm not getting what I want out of this relationship, then I'm out of here. But that is the nature of covenant. That is what God did with Israel. That is how God relates to his people. And I'm just simply saying that is the nature of covenant. And she was rewarded with being able to lead him to the Lord when he was on his deathbed. So if you want to leave, I'm telling you that story. It's because of her faith, because of her commitment to their marriage, that this story is being told today. And if you want to leave a legacy of faithfulness that will impact other people, take these principles that we're sharing with you, apply them to your life, live that way, and you will be surprised how many people will be impacted by your life. Even though it may seem unfair at the time, God's principles are enduring and can be a blessing to many people. So God bless you. If the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do? Building bridges instead of walls, building bridges between islands. I like that story. I like that story. And I couldn't help but think of marriage. We have two people who are individuals, and they come together in marriage, and so they build a land bridge between them. We're going to be one. We are going to be one island. And my wife's been doing doing some study, preparing for a talk on hospitality, and she shared with me this recently, that hospitality is building a bridge to another person, building bridge to other people to overcome isolation. And that's really what marriage is all about. It's building a bridge between two people to overcome isolation. It's not good that man should be alone. It's not good for women to be alone. And so it's building a bridge to overcome isolation. That's what hospitality is. And in our marriages, we should be building lasting, enduring relationships. This afternoon, we want to talk about the more practical side of marriage, talk about communication, talk about some of our differences and how we can make our differences, turn our differences into strengths. And if you have questions, I certainly don't have all the answers, but I would be willing to give you my opinion, and maybe we can even open it up and talk about it. I don't know. If you have questions, go ahead and present them, and we'll take a look at that. So God bless you. I've enjoyed being here and sharing with you, and look forward to more time with you this afternoon. Shall we pray?